From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, physicist Sean Carroll joins us ahead of his talk in Milwaukee on the many worlds theory of quantum behavior. We promise you don't need a physics degree. Then a chef tackles the epidemic of diabetes in the Hispanic population by making a film.
My goal is to try to inspire people to come together in the kitchen and cook together and eat together, and not just one meal for those who have type 2 diabetes and a different meal for those who don't.
A first children's book features a Portuguese water dog, and producer and musician Kieran Vidula celebrates 45 years of hip-hop.
That's really what this show is about, is celebrating the community that I feel is, for one, very misunderstood, and a style of music that's very misunderstood, but has done so much, not only for this country, but like for this city.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. Ever since quantum mechanics came on the scene in 1927, scientists have struggled to reconcile it with Einstein's theory of general relativity. They haven't completely succeeded, and our next guest says that's because they failed to take into account the mysteries of quantum mechanics. Dr. Sean Carroll is a theoretical physicist at the California Institute of Technology. His newest book is Something Deeply Hidden: Quantum Worlds and the Emergence of Space-Time. Dr. Carroll is a leading proponent of what is called the many worlds theory, which says that any time there's a quantum event, copies of the world spin off. Now, those of us who are science fiction fans know and love the idea of multiple universes, but the key word in that sentence has always been fiction. Sean Carroll is with us now. Dr. Carroll, welcome to Lake Effect.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Your newest book is called Something Deeply Hidden, Quantum Worlds and the Emergence of Space-Time. And I suppose I should probably start with, what are quantum worlds and why are there more than one?
Well, yes, you're asking the right questions. You know, quantum mechanics has been with us since roughly the beginning of the 20th century, and embarrassingly, we physicists don't claim to have truly figured out what the theory says. So in the book, I illuminate this problem, you know, why haven't we figured it out, but I also get behind my favorite solution, which is called the many worlds version of quantum mechanics. And honestly, it's just the simplest, most straightforward, take everything at face value solution. When you observe a quantum system, you only see certain outcomes, and many worlds says that's because the world has branched into multiple possibilities, and in all the different possibilities, you saw a different outcome.
Does this have something to do with, in quantum mechanics, if you observe something, it changes the outcome?
Yeah, it has something to do with that. It has something to do with what we call the measurement problem in quantum mechanics. If you just are a physics undergraduate student and you're a sophomore and you're taking your first quantum mechanics course, you're taught two separate rules for how quantum systems behave. One set of rules for when you're not looking at them, and another set of rules for when you are. And this is bizarre, and no one understands. So what do you mean look at it? What do you mean observe, measure? Like, these are not sufficiently rigorously defined terms to really be part of a fundamental theory of nature.
So when we talk about the many world theory, is this affecting us on our what we're looking at right now, the world that we interact with every day, or is this on the quantum level only?
Well, quantum mechanics becomes manifest when you look at microscopic things, when you look at very, very tiny particles. But even though you are not a tiny thing, you're a big thing made of many, many atoms, the individual atoms are tiny. So 5,000 times a second in your body, a radioactive nucleus decays. So that means the wave function of the universe branches into multiple worlds. So there are many, many, many copies of you, very similar, but not quite the same as you perceive yourself right now.
Does this kind of the idea that all of this is, we're all next to each other, but we just can't touch or see each other?
Yeah, I wouldn't even say next to each other, because it's not like there's a location where the other worlds are. They simultaneously exist, but they're not located anywhere. They just are. And yeah, it's almost completely true that they can't talk to each other. They can't affect each other in any way. That's an approximation. But it's a really, really, really good approximation. You would never be able to get a grant proposal accepted if you said, I'm going to wait for evidence that there are other worlds out there.
So the science fiction idea that we could somehow cross into a parallel universe is not happening here.
It's not happening. No, it's that's why we have fiction, because sometimes the real world doesn't let us do all the fun stuff we can imagine.
I know, because that is one of the, as a science fiction fan, I love that idea of these multiple universes affecting each other, and that somehow you could cross over if you just had the right technology.
Yep, that's an idea.
It's just not a good one.
it's nice. It would be fun. It's just not apparently how nature works. Maybe we'll change our minds later.
So why has it been so difficult for physicists to define what quantum worlds and the quantum universe is?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. Part of it is that it is intrinsically hard. Like, it's a conceptually difficult thing to do, to wrap our minds around the fundamental quantum nature of reality. You know, we know that classical mechanics, what Isaac Newton invented, is a good approximation to the quantum world, and our intuition and our everyday view of the world is intrinsically classical. So it's just hard even for trained physicists to think from a quantum-first perspective. The other thing is, there was this choice made in the physics community starting around the 1930s not to worry about it. Not only do they not want to spend a lot of effort and intellectual firepower thinking about the foundations of quantum mechanics, they actively discouraged it. They would push you out of the field if you tried to pursue it. And I think that we're now paying the price for that stubborn insistence on denying the reality of this problem.
You write about that in the book. And why were people so these are people like Niels Bohr, right? It's that era of physicists.
Yes,
they so resistant to trying to define what they were basically playing in?
I mean, it's a very good question, and they weren't all on that side. People like Einstein and Schrödinger, of Schrödinger's cat fame, they fought hard against it, but Bohr and his compatriots, Bohr was extraordinarily charismatic, and people just fell in love with him and followed him. And, you know, also there was other stuff to do. Right? I mean, it was the heyday of nuclear physics and then particle physics and quantum field theory and the Standard Model. And it was just so exciting to forget about the deep questions of quantum theory and worry about what to a physicist seems like a more practical question, like what's inside the neutron, okay? So they just decided to put all their resources into that instead.
And so people like you now are trying to basically fill that knowledge gap. Are there still arguments within the field about what is quantum theory, what is quantum mechanics?
There are arguments, but they aren't nearly as many arguments as they should be. It's still considered a slightly disreputable thing to spend your time worrying about. You know, you ask professional physicists about, you know, some of the questions in the measurement problem of quantum mechanics, and they will just roll their eyes like you're wasting their time. I do think it's changing, and a lot of the change is driven by technology, because it used to be pretty clear that either you were looking at an electron or an atom, some obviously quantum thing, or you're looking at some big apparatus or a cat or a person or a planet, which is a big classical thing. These days, we can work in between on the edge where things are a little quantum but a little classical, and that really demands that we understand better what's going on.
What kinds of things would be on that edge between quantum and classical?
Well, the famous thing would be a quantum computer, right? When we talk about an individual particle, we very well understand sort of the rules of the game. But then in quantum mechanics, when you have two particles, the state, the quantum wave function of two particles, isn't just the wave function for one particle and the wave function for the other particle. It's one wave function for both at once. And this is the phenomenon called quantum entanglement. And it's absolutely crucial to preserve entanglement if you want to build a quantum computer. But anytime you bump into something, the entanglement goes away. So there's a lot of technology, a lot of engineering, as well as a lot of physics involved in bringing these intrinsically quantum phenomena to the stage where we can use them in our technologies.
Where we can bring them into the classical world, essentially.
Basically, we want to shield them from all the interference, all the, you know, warm radiation in the room, right? That's why a lot of quantum computers are cooled down to very, very close to absolute zero.
And so what does quantum computing, we're straying a little bit from what you're talking about in the book, but what does quantum computing give us that more standard, what we think of as, using the word classical for the lack of a better one, a classical computer not do?
Well, interestingly, we're not completely sure about the answer to that question. So it turns out it's a really hard math problem to prove absolutely rigorously how hard a certain kind of computation is. The most important example that we know about is factoring large numbers. So someone gives you a 20-digit number and says, find the numbers you have to multiply by each other to get this 20-digit number. Well, it turns out that's a really, really hard problem. It could take years or decades or centuries on an ordinary classical computer. Maybe you can do it in a few microseconds on a quantum computer, but we haven't proven that yet. So a lot of brain power is going into that.
So it's a possibility, though. That's
absolutely
very cool.
A possibility. That's... Yeah. In fact, it's probably true. There are arguments about what is called quantum supremacy, the idea that there are ways of doing calculations in a quantum computer that are strictly better than those in classical computers, but it's not been proven yet. In fact, it's very funny that what happens in the literature is someone makes a proof, here I have a new quantum algorithm that is faster than any known classical algorithm, and immediately someone else says, okay, I've improved my classical algorithm, now I'm better than yours.
So there's still this battle between the quantum and the classical.
Yeah, and I think that most people believe that the quantum computers will, in principle, be better, but how much better and how quickly we can build them is a tougher thing to figure out.
Well, you mentioned this earlier in our conversation. You talked about the unified field theory, and I know that that is something that physicists have been trying to find, to, you know, the theory of everything.
Yeah.
And so you talk in your book about gravity, which has always been the problem with unified field theory. Does the many-world theory incorporate gravity in a better way?
My answer to that is absolutely yes. And this is not the most popular answer, so I'm, sticking my neck out a little bit. But, you know, again, even as physicists, we are trained to think classically first. And the way that we invent quantum mechanical theories of anything, whether it's a single electron or, you know, atoms and quarks or gravity, is to start with a successful classical theory and what we call quantizing it. But all the attempts to quantize general relativity, which is Einstein's wonderful theory of gravity, have just failed really badly. And so I think that we should at least try forgetting about quantizing any classical theory and just think quantum mechanically from the start without cheating by putting in the classical answers. And that is a program that many worlds is uniquely suited for. So I think it is actually an enormous help in that regard.
When you come to places like Milwaukee, what are the questions that people have for you that either surprise you or maybe don't surprise you?
Well, you know, I think that Many Worlds has a little bit of a bad reputation. You know, the name is provocative and fun and gets people's attention, but really gets some people's attention in the wrong way, right? They don't want to believe that there are many copies of them floating around and being created all the time. And the theory itself, you know, the existence of all these many worlds is not the essence of the many worlds version of quantum mechanics. It's a prediction. It's sort of a spin-off. The theory itself is just very pure and simple and straightforward. So really what I have to do is convince people that we didn't just throw in a whole bunch of extra worlds to an otherwise successful theory of quantum mechanics. We removed a bunch of unneeded rules that we teach our students, and the many worlds are just a consequence of doing that. It really is a simple, rigorous, falsifiable scientific theory.
So what are some of those rules that you have gotten rid of?
Well, you know, like we said, when you look at a quantum system, when you measure something, the ordinary textbook formulation has a whole separate list of rules where the wave function collapses and there's a probability of getting different outcomes. And Many Worlds says, look, what you're forgetting is that you are a quantum system also, right? You're not really a classical system, even if you are big and lumbering compared to the atom. So you should treat yourself as a quantum system that interacts under the ordinary laws of physics with whatever system you're looking at. And if you do that, it is just popping out right from the formulas that you will split. You will turn into many copies of yourself.
If there was one misconception about the many worlds theory that you would like to make sure people just get rid of, what would that be?
Yeah, you know, I think one simple misconception, there are many, so I'll have to pick one. One is a worry about the conservation of energy, right? Like if I take one universe and suddenly copy it into two universes, where did all the energy come from to do that? Which sounds like a really legitimate worry, but in fact, what's really going on is more like I had one thick universe and I sliced it into two almost identical copies that are thinner than the original one. So the total amount of universe doesn't change. The total amount of energy doesn't change. In many worlds, energy and other things like that are perfectly well conserved. There's no fundamental worry that, you know, your favorite parts of ordinary physics are being thrown to the wind here.
Okay, so that's the thermodynamics, right? Where energy can't be created or eliminated.
That's right.
We are so looking forward to having you here. This is going to be an amazing conversation. And I want to thank you for helping those of us who love this stuff but don't really get it a little better.
Thank you very much. I think, you know, we'll have a few laughs at the talk, so I hope people can come.
Sean Carroll, it has been such a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Sean Carroll is a theoretical physicist at the California Institute of Technology. His newest book is Something Deeply Hidden, Quantum Worlds and the Emergence of Space-Time. Dr. Carroll will be talking about the book and his research Thursday evening at the Fireside Lounge. It's on the second floor of the UWM Student Union. Boswell Book Company and UWM are co-sponsors of that event, and you can find out more at wuwm.com. We'll take a short break and then meet a chef whose passion for healthy cooking has been captured in a new film. We'll find out more when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. The Minority Health Film Festival kicks off in Milwaukee on Thursday. This will be the first festival of its kind in the country, offering not just films, but community forums and a health fair, all related to the health issues facing racial and ethnic minority populations. Diabetes is one of those issues the festival is highlighting. More than 30 million American adults are living with the disease, and in the Hispanic population, more than 50% of both men and women are affected. Chef Leticia Moreno-Schwartz is featured in the documentary A Touch of Sugar, which screens this Saturday. In the film, the chef uses her passion for healthy cooking to help a Hispanic woman with type 2 diabetes improve her eating habits. Moreno-Schwartz herself has personal history with diabetes. Her grandfather passed away from its complications. Chef Moreno-Schwartz explains her involvement in this project to Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski.
Leticia Moreno-Schwartz, thank you for joining me on Lake Effect today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So the film A Touch of Sugar is a documentary that confronts America's diabetes crisis one community at a time. So can you explain your role in this documentary and how it touches upon the way diabetes impacts the Hispanic community in the USA?
In the movie, in the film, I play the role of myself, which is a chef, you know, looking to share my passion for healthy cooking and to help people, especially in the Hispanic community, improve their eating habits as, you know, many people struggle to manage their type 2 diabetes, especially when they are, you know, in underserved communities or rural communities. So I see that a lot in this country, that, you know, underserved communities are definitely more affected by type 2 diabetes.
Right. And what elements impact someone's treatment for type 2 diabetes?
There are so many varieties, Audrey, that, you know, can be caused to the impact. Like, for example, language barriers is one for sure. Access to information and education, sometimes even basic things like cooking classes, nutritional classes. If you have access to those, you're much better off. And there are many people who don't. And even the stigma. I feel that there is a certain stigma that affects people with type 2 diabetes, and just cultural influences also, because sometimes it can be very linked to, you know, the foods that a certain culture, and in my case, the Latin community, will stick to eating.
Right. And considering that more than 50% of Hispanic men and women are affected by diabetes in the U.S., that is a very drastic and direct correlation.
Correct.
So I'm curious, what was your relationship with food like growing up, and what influenced you to become a chef?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I actually, like, I have a personal connection with type 2 diabetes. When I was very young, my grandfather was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, and I kind of like grew up watching my grandmother and my grandfather kind of like fight constantly, because she would isolate him and she would not prepare the same kinds of foods that the rest of the family would eat. And I think that after the loss of my grandfather, we kind of like realized that we had to reevaluate the whole thing. And especially growing up in Brazil, that wasn't very hard to do, because it lends to, you know, I grew up in Rio de Janeiro, which is it's a city right on the beach. So it's something that, you know, it was very easy to start incorporating exercising and fresh produce and fruits and vegetables into our lifestyle. But I definitely remember, you know, the fight between my grandparents. And I feel that it's something that it still happens a lot. I think that one of the trickiest points about type 2 diabetes is that, you know, you should never isolate a member of the family. And as a chef, that's my goal, is to try to inspire people to come together in the kitchen and cook together and eat together, and not just one meal for those who have type 2 diabetes and a different meal for those who don't. You know, I think that what I'm trying to do with the movie, with my books, with my work, is to show that healthy meals can still be delicious. I think that we still have a lot of people associating, oh, this is too healthy for me, this is too boring, you know, this is tasteless, flavorless. And my goal is to show exactly the opposite. It's that healthy food can be absolutely delicious, full of flavor, and that you can crave for a salad. You can crave for a quinoa with mushrooms and chicken sausage that are healthy and delicious for you. And the other thing is that I try to really encourage, again, people coming together in the kitchen, because I think that in this country, what we're seeing right now is nobody has time for anything. Like, it's the biggest excuse, right? We have like, what, 300 emails in our mailboxes, and nobody has time to cook. Nobody has time to exercise, and we're getting sicker and fatter, you know, and the answer is right in front of us. We can be a healthier nation if we cook more and we eat, you know, better food.
You mentioned the family aspect, the communal aspect of cooking together, of eating together. And often people get very attached to those traditional family recipes. You know, there's one way to make it. You need these ingredients. And do you find that there's often a lot of resistance when you're bringing these modified and new recipes that are a healthier twist on a classic dish? You know, whatever community you're trying to influence, we all have our dishes that we don't want to change, even if it's going to be better for us.
Right. Definitely, I see every once in a while, I see like, you know, this so-called resistance, like, no, I don't want to try this. For example, in my new cookbook, I am offering a new version of rice and beans. Rice and beans is the backbone, you know, of Latin culture. And my whole life, I grew up eating rice and beans, white rice and black beans. And all of a sudden, I created this version, which is more like, you know, a mixture of wild rice, brown rice, beans, and a lot of vegetables, you know, giving flavor, almost like a sofrito. And it's absolutely delicious, and it's so much healthier. So until they try, you know, that resistance, I usually find that, you know, you end it until you try. The same thing happens with, for example, brigadeiro. Brigadeiro is a candy. It's a Brazilian candy. It's more like a chocolate truffle or a chocolate fudge. And originally, it is made with sweetened condensed milk and Nesquik, which is, you know, a very sugary cocoa powder, right? And I mean, it's delicious. And in every birthday celebration in Latin America, you'll see a version of brigadeiro. But then I created this healthy version of brigadeiro made with coconut milk and enrobed in cocoa nibs instead of chocolate sprinkles. And usually people, I gave a few to even my family. They said, healthy brigadeiro, I don't think there's any such a thing as healthy brigadeiro. And then they try. And then it's like, oh my goodness, this is amazing, you know? So I think that when you have good food, it's a win situation. The food speaks for itself.
Right. And when it comes to your recipe development, whether, like you said, you're modifying a traditional backbone recipe or making something new, what are you keeping in mind for making a recipe for people with diabetes? Are there certain food groups you are avoiding, ones to make more of? You mentioned you're supplementing ingredients, adding more vegetables. Is there a formula to what you're doing?
Well, this formula is very vague because the truth is diabetes is not the kind of disease that one size fits all, which is the reason why, and I say it all the time, remember, I am a chef, I'm not a doctor. So the most important thing is for each person to work with their doctors to develop a treatment plan that's right for you so that each person can be on top of their A1C goal. A1C is really a blood sugar test that doctors use to look at your sugar levels over a period of 2 to 3 months. And it's one of the most important terms in the vocabulary of diabetes because it can tell you whether you are managing, you know, the treatment plan, you know, in a proper way. And that too will help you guide the foods you may or may not want to eat. So some people might not even be, you know, able to eat bananas, while other people can eat bananas because it's fruit and it's natural. So it's really an individualized, it's case by case. But going back to your original question, overall, I try to, you know, make substitutions, generally speaking, that are, you know, that just make a recipe more diabetes friendly and healthier in general. So, for example, one of the recipes that I offer in our campaign, America's Diabetes Challenge, is arroz con pollo, which is a very classic, you know, Latin dish. And instead of using white rice, I use brown rice. Instead of using regular chorizo, I use turkey sausage. You know, so there's always small substitutions that you can, you know, make to turn a dish a little bit healthier.
What have you found to be people's biggest first step challenge when it comes to changing their lifestyle in order to live with type 2 diabetes? You mentioned your role in this documentary is being a helpful guide for a person in the kitchen. What's their main, not necessarily mental holdup, but what do they find to be the biggest first step for them?
I think that when people first receive the diagnosis, it's kind of like the end of the world. And then little by little, they discover that living with type 2 diabetes certainly has its challenges, but the disease can be managed with the help of a strong support system and just by working with your doctor and developing a plan that's individualized and right for you. You know, I think that that resistance that we mentioned just a minute ago also plays a role into they receiving the diagnosis. Sometimes it's like, do you really need to receive the diagnosis that you have type 2 diabetes to know that you have to exercise, to know that you have to make time to cook at home and eat healthy foods? So again, it's kind of like, people, we don't need to go that far. You don't need to see a nutritionist to know that, you know, an apple is so much better than a bag of chips. But I feel that there's a lot of people out there who need that shake, but that shake might come a little too late. So what we try to inspire in this movie is for people to take action, for people to come together, for people to exercise together. Like, if you have a member of your family that have type 2 diabetes, be a partner with them, exercise together, cook together, you know, and just like there are very small steps that you can do in cooking, there are small steps that you can do just in life, you know, on a day by day, like park your car a little bit farther so that you can walk a little more. Don't take the elevator and go up the stairs, you know, things like that. You need to kind of like always think about, you know, small steps that you can make to live a healthier lifestyle.
Well, Leticia Moreno-Schwartz, thank you again so much for taking a little bit of time to speak with me today.
Thank you so much, Audrey. It's my pleasure.
Leticia Moreno-Schwartz is a chef, cookbook author, and spokesperson for America's Diabetes Challenge. She's featured in the new documentary called A Touch of Sugar. It'll be showing this Saturday at the Minority Health Film Festival in Milwaukee. She spoke with Audrey Nowakowski, and there's more information at WUWM.com. Writing your first book can be a daunting task, but when your subject is your Portuguese water dog puppy, that task becomes a little easier. Amanda Lowney is a Milwaukee-based writer and the author of Zora the Water Dog, a children's book that looks at her dog's journey from her littermates to Lowney's lap. The first-time author spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about her book and her decision to enter the world of children's literature.
When you looked at children's literature as a whole, What were the things that you found, you know, inspirational, and what were the things you felt were missing?
I feel like there's a lot of personal stories in children's literature, which I think is great, and I use that when I was writing as well. I feel like sometimes in children's literature, you're not really getting a lesson or something for the kids to take away when they're done reading the book. So that's something I wanted to focus on as well.
Now, you drew from your own personal experience, of course. The book is called Zora the Water Dog, and you have an actual Zora.
I do, and she's an awesome dog.
Now, what interested you about water dogs?
You know, when we were looking for a dog, we really did a lot of research on different breeds and different dogs and what we were looking for. And I think the Portuguese water dog is really... they're a fun dog. They like to have fun. They like to run around. They have a lot of energy. But at the same time, they're snuggly. They really like to be comforted. They really like to be part of a pack. They're a great dog with children. She's just been great as a family dog.
And they were the former presidential dog.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the Obamas, I think, had one or two Portuguese water dogs. That's right.
Bo and Sonny.
Yep.
What did you find inspiring about, you know, the purchasing process of Zora? Because that's really what this is about.
It was kind of a process for us. You know, we knew we wanted to get a dog. We did a lot of research, and we found somebody that had a litter, and we went and met them. We actually had the pick of the litter, so it was cool to go and, I mean, there was 11 puppies. We got to go and see all their different personalities, and she had sent us pictures, so we kind of had an idea of which one we wanted. But then when we got there, we saw Zora, and she was biting at our shoelaces. She was running around. She was trying to get her attention. She wasn't the one that we originally thought we were going to get, and she picked us, I feel like.
Now, the book really gets into what that process was like, I think, for Zora. You know, you talked about earlier wanting to have a real message to the story. And to you, what is the message of this book?
Yeah, I kind of tried to look at it from Zora's perspective. Even when we left with her that day, I just felt bad, you know, taking her from her family. And it made me think of, you know, what emotions is she going through as a puppy, I know. But, you know, it just made me think. So I tried to take her perspective of the huge life change, you know, going from your mom and your litter mates to a strangers in a new house. And I just tried to, you know, take that in the book and kind of go from there.
One of the things that really attracted me to the book was the illustrations by Mainu. How did you hook up with Mainu? Because it's my understanding that she's in a far-off country.
She is. She's located in Vietnam. She's been amazing. So when I wrote the book, I wasn't really sure if I was going to do anything with it. And when I decided to do something with it, I was just online looking for ways to find an illustrator. I found a handful of people and I sent out some emails. She by far was amazing in the information she sent back to me. She knew what she was doing and I loved her illustrations. So we just started working together and it fit great.
Now, how depictive is this of Zora, would you say?
As a puppy?
Yeah.
Very much so. I mean, that was Zora as a puppy. She was all over the place. She was very excited all the time, running around. That was Zora. Now she's about five, a little over five. And she slowed down a little bit. She, you know, likes her naps.
So when a child reads this book or a parent is reading this book to their child, more likely, what do you hope they take away from it?
You know, change can be good. It's scary and it's hard sometimes, but it can be really great and fun.
Well, Amanda, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thanks so much, Joy. I really appreciated you having me here.
Amanda Lowney is a Milwaukee-based writer and the author of Zora the Water Dog. Lowney and the real-life Zora will be at Barktoberfest this Saturday. You can find more information at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break and then chat with musicians Kieran Vidula and Webster X ahead of their hip-hop DNA concert this Friday. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. 2019 marks the 45th anniversary of the birth of hip-hop. This Friday, the Marcus Center will play host to Hip-Hop DNA Volume 1. Produced by Kieran Vidula of Cue the Sun, Hip-Hop DNA will explore almost five decades of music and dance and also pay some special attention to Milwaukee's own hip-hop scene. The list of participating Milwaukee musicians and dancers is long and impressive, and one of them, Webster X, joined Kieran Vidula and me in the studio to talk about hip-hop, life, and everything. We will hear more of that in just a bit, but first of all, I want to welcome Webster X and Cue the Sun, Kieran Vidula. It is so great to have you both in the studio.
Hello, hello.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So we're going to talk about hip-hop today, and we're going to talk about it in sort of a big sense, and I know there's a great performance that's coming up that we'll talk about as well, but it's like 45 years. We were talking about that before we turned on the microphones, and I realized that I was stunned to realize the number, that it has really been 45 years since really the birth of hip-hop. I thought it was much younger than that. And it's been maybe because it just feels like it's part of the culture.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that 45 is the mark of when hip-hop as a style, we know it, but hip-hop is really a continuation and the story of America as a whole. So I think the story even goes back to 1492 and before, as far as how these instruments and these rhythms and these different cultures came together to finally turn into what we call hip-hop today, which really includes every style of music ever within it.
So tell me, what was the moment that was considered the birth of modern hip-hop?
So, yeah, this is the most, it's pretty much universally recognized as the birth. In 1979, a DJ by the name of DJ Kool Herc, who was living at the Bronx at the time, and in the 70s, the Bronx was literally looking like a third world country, crumbling buildings, no kind of resources, nothing.
It was a war zone.
Yeah, literally, between the gangs and everything. But music, as always, was the saving grace for the spirit of the people, particularly the young people, as well as visual art and dance. But there was several DJs who started hosting these kind of underground parties at youth centers and at different public spaces out in basketball courts. And that was happening for a while through the 70s. And also in the 70s, the downtown disco scene was really blowing up for the first time. That didn't really exist like that in the 60s and prior to that. So there was the party culture of this kind of glitzy, you know, highfalutin crowd downtown. And then you had the people in the Bronx and the smaller boroughs of New York, and obviously in other states around the country, But DJ Kool Herc's party started to become more recognized because he wasn't really playing the disco music because, you know, as every era of music has, there's people who like the modern day mainstream and there's people who are looking for the original soul. So he was sampling from James Brown and several artists from the previous soul and funk generation at his parties. And people were connecting with that more raw sound. They just felt it in a better way. So more people were dancing at his parties. So when more people are dancing, they're having more fun. So more people start coming.
So he was the one who did the double.
Yeah. So what happened is once he found those records, he noticed that there was particular moments when the singer stopped singing and most of the band dropped out. It would drop down to pretty much just drums and a funky bass line. And that became known as the break. So he took the technique that the downtown DJs were using of using two turntables to fade back and forth. But instead of playing the whole songs, he was like, well, people are dancing the most during these breaks. So what I'll do is I'll either get the same, two of the same record or another record that has a break in a similar tempo. And then instead of playing the full song, he could just transition from one break to the next. And therefore, and me knowing this from experience DJing too, the dance floor is a very sensitive thing. You can kill the dance floor with one wrong move. Or it's kind of like a video game, like the power-up button. Like the more good you give them, the higher energy goes. And so that's really what it was about, was getting people to dance longer that popularized his technique.
So Webstrex, when did you start doing this stuff?
When I start rapping?
Yeah.
Oh, man. I mean, I technically didn't really start doing it until I was about 14. It's really funny because what we're about to get into today was actually the first song I actually wrote a rap verse to, which was Lil Wayne's 6 Foot, 7 Foot. So, yeah, man, I just got into it through, you know, things like what was, you know, really popping during my age, which was the 50 Cent era, the Lil Wayne era, the Jay-Z era, Black Album era. You know, that was really it for me, and that's what kind of sucked me into hip-hop. But I would go back, you know, do my homework, and my sister showed me Tribe Called Quest, Midnight Marauders, and that, like, flipped my world upside down. So,
yeah, I was going to say, that's a classic.
Oh, yeah.
That is classic. And that's, that to me, that's where I think of when it starts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's still today known as the golden era because, you know, like I said, that music started as a party music, but in the early 90s with groups like A Tribe Called Quest and many others, De La Soul, it started bringing the more spiritual and political knowledge with the lyrical swag and the cool beats and everything. So it kind of reached that perfect blend of party music and spiritual knowledge of self type messages in there, and then obviously it continued to evolve into other things over the years, but that's what it was at its sweet spot of really what hip hop culture is all about.
Well, and this concert that you guys are doing, Hip Hop DNA, I'm assuming with the word DNA in there that you're looking back,
yeah,
but also pushing it forward.
Absolutely. Yeah, so I made, you know, this show is called Volume One because it's really the music in the show is one leaf on a giant family tree. There's so many artists that I'm not touching who I'm a big fan of, like Nas or Outkast. And but the way I chose the songs for this particular show were based partially in their creativity or how the sample might have been used. The fact that certain samples have been used in multiple hits over the decades. And I wanted a combination of the foundational songs from that time of DJ Kool Herc and songs from today that represent the trap sound. And, you know, both of us work with a lot of high school and middle school students, and we want to make this something that's not just for people in their 30s and 40s, but that we can get the teenagers interested in that as well and feel like the music that they know as hip-hop is also represented in this.
How does Milwaukee fit into the greater hip-hop history and story?
It doesn't yet on a national scale, but the thing is, Milwaukee and with us, you know, having seen many iterations over the years, we really have a similar circumstance as the Bronx in the 80s. Like, hip-hop almost started from ground zero here in the late 90s in the same way that it started in the late 70s, mm-hmm. You know, coming out of immense racial inequality, segregation, And there was a lot of early artists who were doing things and kept getting shut down, you know, parties and youth centers and all these things. But finally, it's at a moment now where there are resources, whether it's radio stations or, you know, other local organizations that are now really opening their doors to the culture. And
the internet.
Yeah, the internet has opened it up. And that's played a big part in Sam Webster X's is his ability to use the internet to branch out of Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. And then so it's brought a lot more energy and attention. And then a lot of other artists have been following in his footsteps and stuff too. Oh. And again, it comes out of the idea of we didn't have resources, so we just met up at friends' basements, or we started our own all-age venue, or and now that's progressed to the point where we're able to, even though we don't have a definitive sound, we have a definitive culture that we're building, because we have a lot more ownership over it. And we're seeing all the large arts organizations are now, you know, they're celebrating the work of this local scene as a way of really amplifying the overall arts and culture of the whole city. So I think that's really what this show is about, is celebrating the community that I feel is, for one, very misunderstood, and a style of music that's very misunderstood, but has done so much, not only for this country, but like for this city, especially over the past 5-6 years, as the city's really been growing in a lot of ways. And I say that hip hop is the true American dream, because you can take Bach and then you can take some Hungarian hand clapping folk rhythm, and you can take, you know, Afro-Cuban vocal, and you can mix them all together through sampling, and all of these cultures can exist and cross-influence each other within.
Yeah, I think one of the big misperceptions is that when you talk about grabbing all of these different influences, I think what I hear is that, well, it's not real music.
Yeah.
It's just stealing sounds. And what people, I think, don't understand is you're composing.
Yes.
You're actually composing. It's just like taking any other sound and putting it on to whatever you're writing. And so it is a composition. This is, you know, what you're doing, and you're going to show us how you, or at least a little bit about how you do it.
Yes.
You're composing.
Yes.
And it's the same thing with rapping over it, with the lyrics. You're composing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, to me, from the outside looking in, is one of the big misperceptions, is this is not real music.
Yes. Yeah.
It's just kind of like, oh yeah, anyone can throw that crap together. No.
Right.
Well, let's hear something.
Yeah.
So what are you going to do? Tell us what this is.
So I wanted to share a few different samples before I have Sam share one of the songs that we're going to be performing. And the other thing about the show is we'll be performing all the electronics, all the sample with a completely live band. There'll be no pre-recorded loops. There'll be nothing like that. This is Diana Ross's I'm Coming Out. And this is the original, you know, intro to that song. But basically, this is sampled in a song called Mo' Money, Mo' Problems, which if you're my age, this was every school dance, everything. So then, you know, so this is just a verbatim. He took that intro, looped about 8 bars of it, and then added all these other percussion instruments, you know, and then this is just the instrumental of it, but then, you know, got a great song off it, and this is one of the biggest hits of the 90s. That's kind of more looked down upon, even in the producer world, because, you know, you want to show more creativity with it. The other type of sample that I really love is when it's kind of an artist that's sampled that you would never readily associate with hip-hop. I think I was on here once talking about nostalgia music with Mitch, you know, and songs that your parents love and stuff. Harry Belafonte was a big fat favorite of my dad's, but Harry Belafonte is known as this very spiritual, very politically minded artist from this kind of golden, clean-cut era. And then for a Harry Belafonte song to be sampled in a Lil Wayne song, where if you look at Lil Wayne, he's an alien from another planet, right?
Well, particularly compared to Harry Belafonte. Yeah, exactly.
And I'm not saying this to take away from his artistry, because he's one of the most influential rappers, definitely of this generation, but maybe of all time. But just from a physical and lifestyle standpoint, two diametrically opposed people. Yeah, you'll hear both the 6-foot, 7-foot. in the intro to the beat, and then you'll hear the stock banana to the stock banana in the background of the beat for the verses. So
pay close attention.
Here's the Webster X remix of 6 Foot 7 Foot by Lil Wayne.
Yeah. Hit up DNA. Hey. Excuse my swagger, rapper with an actor. Kill every line every time that I have to. Aiming for the green like I was playing in the Masters. Graduation day, my haters clapping in the rafters. Money in that Cobra clutch, shorty's playing double dutch. Be my sermon, Uma Thurman, hit you with that 1-inch punch. Mess around and spill your lunch. Peter Piper had a hunch that I'm a genius in the game, and you were looking like a dunce. Dancing with the devil, but an angel hit the Harlem Shake. I don't want no parts in that, I Ricky Bobby shake and bake. I Rick and Morty had to space, you're looking at the head of state. Hold up, wait, I am not a bouncer, but I see the fake. Searching for the soul, I think I found it through Anita Bake. I'ma hear a nitty beat and let the bass seal my fate. Smoking in a dream on the pace. Sugar real sexy, I'ma kiss the face. Someone to go like you in the bait. You looking at me crazy, you can catch the fade. Bleed a bit to beat the case, then I see you round the way. Throw your hands up, y'all, and say, hey,
hey, hey.
Turn 13, Vogel Hall, Hip Hop
hey.
DNA.
Hey,
cue the sound production.
Hey, 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 hey.
Just like that.
Just like that.
Just like that.
That happened in the studio.
Spit all over the mic.
Yeah, that's all right. That's all right. So give me the details. Who else besides you two is going to be in it, and where and when?
Yeah, so all of the members of New Age Narcissism will be in the show. Lex Allen, Lord Freddy, Siren, Webster X, Chris Gilbert, who will also be choreographing. A good amount of my students from COA Youth and Family Centers, like from the 10-year-olds to the teens, will be in the show. We've got Panadansa Dance Company. We've got Arabi School of Dance, which is an Indian style. I had to represent my own culture, too. So we've got some Kathak dancers and Bollywood style dancers. We've got traditional break dancers. We've got Vincent Van Great. We've got Cecilio Negron, from people will recognize him from De La Buena. So it's really a cross of, we got Be Free. It's a cross of so many musical styles and musicians and singers. Marcy Daniel, and a lot of younger artists too. At 35, I'm one of the oldest people in the whole show. Most of the people are in their early 20s and teens.
It is going to be such a good night.
Yes,
such
a
good night. I want to thank you both for coming in and sharing a little bit of it. It was nice to get a little lesson on how all of that gets put together and to hear about the history of it. But here's to another 45 years.
Thank you so much.
Hey, cheers.
Kieran Vidula's Cue the Sun is producing Hip Hop DNA Volume 1 this Friday evening at the Marcus Center. Webster X will perform along with a number of other Milwaukee-based musicians and dancers. There is a link to more information at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.